and welcome to Crit Club, a show where four friends watch movies they've never seen from the Criterion Channel streaming service and then talk about them to their heart's content. My name is Peter Allen Clark, your host this week, and I'm joined by three of the finest film lovers in North America. I'm joined by Corey. Hello, Corey.
Hello.
I'm joined by Angela. Hello there, Angela.
Can I have 30 more minutes, please?
Yes, you may.
Okay, good. I'm going to write more song lyrics for like another 30 minutes and make that waiter be really pissed off about it.
Okay, and I'm also joined by Wizard Chris. Hello, Wizard.
Hello, it's Wizard, where telling the truth is a dangerous business.
There you go. Perfect. Yes, there we are. As you all can tell, this week we are setting off to a distant desert, where a small local faction takes on an evil empire and their flying machines with the help of some of America's biggest celebrities. No, listeners, I'm sorry. We're not talking about Dune Part 2. Of course, this is the infamous 1987 box office bomb by the name of Ishtar. It was too close. I had to do it, right?
No,
it was too.
It's a lot of similarities. They are more
There are a lot of similarities. Ishtar. We're watching Ishtar. Written and directed by legendary screenwriter and comedian Elaine May, Ishtar follows two hapless middle-aged songwriters played by Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman who fall ass backwards into a job at a Moroccan nightclub. But once they arrive in Africa, they become the pawns of multiple forces all trying to use them for their old Cold War espionage ends. Oh, and there's shtick. There's lots of shtick.
Sticky.
But that's just the story of the movie. The story around the movie is probably more well known due to a multitude of reported factors, including studio interference, director perfectionism, the hardships of shooting in Morocco, rumors of the movie's woeful production spread around. And you couple that with reports of entrenched critics looking to get back at Warren Beatty's bright stardom and pop culture's willingness to take pleasure in Hollywood's pain. And you get a big box office bomb, like I said. But this was kind of bigger than big. Ishtar became sort of shorthand for an expensive bomb. I guess it's kind of like the Cleopatra of our more modern era. But now we're 37 years later or something, with some time to clear the air and some perspective to reevaluate some of the cultural representation, we're watching it again here. And so I ask you, Crit Club, did Ishtar prove to be an oasis in the desert of its reputation? Or were you sold the exact blind camel that you had asked for? And Angel's making faces.
Are you sure
I'm just
you don't
want
to make four or five more jokes that are exactly the same about that blind camel?
Oh my God!
I can already see my stomach. The lines are being drawn.
But because Angela was making faces, I'm going right to you, Angela. What did you think of Ishtar?
When those helicopters came, I was hoping that they would come and take me away. And then when they started shooting, I was like, "Fine, kill me
okay.
now."
Great.
Because. This movie, even, you know, with this bad reputation already, you know, giving it a bad, you know, I had a low esteem for it just to begin with. I despise Warren Beatty. Like,
when
it
cut,
why? Right? Oh my God. He gives me the icks, the cringes. Like, I legit, like, if I meet a guy who has Warren Beatty energy, I will turn right around. Forget about it. No, thank you. Maybe it's the whole Bonnie and Clyde thing. But he just,
I'm Googling right now, Warren Beatty, Me Too, just to read up. Oh yeah. Oh, there's stuff.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. There's stuff. Yeah. Uh-huh. And so also this was like probably the worst casting in the history of all cinema. And I thought it was overblown, but no, they took these huge movie stars and put them in this movie when they really needed like self-effacing or like ridiculous, clueless, some great comedians on here. I didn't buy either of these characters for a second, and to the point where every time they opened their mouths, I was annoyed and didn't care about who they were, what they cared about. Because also the characters themselves were not very believable, or not framed in ways that were believable. And so this is probably the worst movie we've ever seen on Crit Club, in my humble opinion.
Belladonna of Sadness?
Anyone? I'm sorry, what?
The Hour of the Wolf? You said we'll The Hour there. Of the Wolf was the most problematic movie you've seen.
Yeah, I hate Hour of the Wolf, too. This is a problematic movie, too. Like, oh, my God. Yeah, so much. I just really hated this movie.
I feel like you've said... Go ahead, sorry.
I didn't listen to much of it. I turned the volume down low because I just couldn't. It felt like daggers in my whole body every time either Dustin Hoffman or Warren Beatty opened their mouths because they were just so stupid. But not stupid. Like, I would love to see, like, if Jim Carrey and who is the Dumb and Dumberer guy, if they did this movie, that would have been fucking hilarious, right? But
I have in my notes, this is very proto Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah. And that's the other pain of this movie is that actually, like, if all of these ridiculous entities hadn't interfered with this film, it might have actually been a funny and poignant film. But it was complete Hollywood excess. And also, just how many times do I need to see these two stuck in a desert? Like, it just goes on and on and on forever. I'm sorry. I want to be, you know me, I'm always looking for the good in a movie, and this was not, maybe it was my headspace today, didn't get much sleep, but it's, no thank you.
Wizard, how are you feeling about Ishtar?
Oh, you know, this is an interesting movie. It is a thoroughly middling late 80s comedy. It works sometimes. It totally doesn't work more times than it does. There are some genuinely funny moments in this movie that I've found myself laughing out loud. I'm sorry, guys. The Blind Camel is funny. The Blind Camel is so funny. These guys are trying to have a conversation, and the camel, this stupid camel, is just wailing and making the most objectionable noises. That is like Tim and Eric comedy. That is like funny, annoying. That is annoying comedy that like gets in your head, and you're like, that is funny. Well done, everyone. I recognize... You know, where for every blind camel, there's the arms meet scene where Dustin Hoffman just rattles off some gibberish. I found that extremely off-putting and not funny.
Offensive.
Very not funny. Offensive not just to the good people of Morocco, but offensive to comedians who could easily have massaged that into a funnier scene. If I were a professional comedian, I'd be very upset. It's weird to see these like leading men do this like Dumb and Dumber shtick. Like Warren Beatty's character Lyle is like Forrest Gump level stupid, mm-hmm. like, which is so strange. Like, so strange to see the star of Reds do like Manchild.
Doofy. I kept thinking the word doofy.
He's doofy. That being said, there are scenes that are very funny. When Dustin Hoffman is on the ledge and like Warren Beatty goes out to try and collect him, and Dustin Hoffman's parents are there, and oh my God, the rabbi's here, and that shit was funny. There are genuinely funny moments in this movie. Friend of the pod, Charles Grodin, is in this movie. He does not get Charles to be Grodin. Very funny, but he is in the movie. You know, throughout the movie, my favorite part, though, is easily that these guys are 50. I was watching the movie, and I couldn't figure out what I thought was so weird about it, like, in the first, like, 10, 20 minutes. And then I was like, how old were these fucking guys when they made this movie? They were both 50 years old. This is a hilarious movie about two men in, like, a midlife crisis. They've been songwriters for, like, 5 weeks. And, like, before we met Carol Kane and Warren Beatty's soon-to-be ex-wife, I was like, there is a part of this movie where there were women and now there are no women because the women were like, this is awful. I can't be near these people. It is nowhere near the worst movie ever made. It is nowhere near the worst movie that we've seen on this podcast. Its only sin is that it's kind of meh. And all the weird racial stuff. And, like, they have a white female, secondary who has, like a Moroccan name. Like, just get a non-white actor to play the love interest. She was dating Warren Beatty at the time.
Of course she was.
Okay.
She is also half Algerian.
Okay. I'll take it. It's just like a middling movie, and the lore and the legacy, like lower end of the middle. But the lore and the legacy are far more interesting than the movie itself. There are some good jokes. There are some mostly bad jokes. And then it's over. And at the end, I was kind of like, well, that was nowhere near as bad as I was led to believe. And this is why the Razzies are such garbage. Like, it's just this is like. It's such like an oasis for humorless Los Angeles Hollywood people. I don't know what to say. I think I've ranted about the Razzies before, so I won't again. But I will say Ishtar, meh.
Corey, Ishtar, meh or meh?
Yeah, I think I'm somewhere between Angela and Chris on this. So it is definitely on the lower end of the spectrum. It's better than A New Leaf. I'll say that. Which I gave a 5, so we can see it's at least a
also
5 out of 20.
Also directed, also written and directed and co-starring Elaine May, just yes. For listeners. Yeah.
And I think last time when we were talking about it, I was saying like, oh, it's like one of the most famous, like worst movies ever. And then like upon looking it up, it's like, oh no, it's not really like the worst movie ever. It's famous Hollywood flop, Hollywood bomb, like overbloated, you know, and just sort of didn't make its money back and all that stuff. And so like, yeah, this isn't the worst movie ever. It's like, I don't even want to call it like, it feels weird calling it a bad movie because it's not like so bad that it's good or anything like that. It is more just like, meh. It's
dude,
like,
Hard Ticket to Hawaii is a better movie than this.
Yeah, right. Like that's a fun, bad movie. This is just a blech, bad movie. This is like be bad, be offensive, be incompetent, but just don't be boring. And this movie was so bad. Boring. And like when it does do a joke, it then just has this like desire to just run it into the ground and keep redoing it. And like there's so many scenes of just like two people sitting down and having a conversation about stuff, and I'm like, you should be doing something else. Something else should be going on here. And like the number one like focus of dialogue should be for the audience. The dialogue is there for the audience. The dialogue is not to like recap all the other stuff that's happened to another character who was off screen and didn't see it happen. Like that's boring to sit through. I will say though, the first act of this movie is really good. The first act, I was on board. Like when they were like just the struggling, middle-aged, doofy, like loser guys in New York, like that have this like half-hearted dream to make it. I was like, am I enjoying this? What is this? This is silly. I don't know. I thought this was like a fantasy movie. I thought it was like taking place on some like fantasy desert level thing or whatever. And when they were just like in just regular old New York, I'm like, are they going to open a magical cupboard and escape into Ishtar? I had no idea where this movie was going. But I really liked the first act of it. And I think that like the acceleration or the momentum from the first act of the movie could have been rewritten into something else that was probably even better. I didn't read up on this as much as I wanted to coming in because I wanted to read like a little bit more about the history and stuff. But I remember seeing at some point someone saying to them, like, just keep the story in New York.
Dustin Hoffman wanted it in New York.
And I think that probably would have been a better movie. They had a lot of good setup there. But yeah, at the end of the day, just kind of, eh. Peter, what did you think of Ishtar?
One day I'm going to like a movie I pick the least out of all of you. I don't think this was a good movie. I do think this was better than it has any right to be. I'm kind of in line, maybe a little bit above Wizard on this. Like, I fucking laughed a lot. Like,
laughed more than
some
I did
of that shtick was, I don't know. Okay, so there are a few things here. Like, I think it's, like, I see, Angela, I see your rejection of Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty as these characters. Like, they're not that type, but I kind of found that fascinating. And this is, I will say, the best I've ever liked Warren Beatty. Like, he didn't fit into it perfectly, but you could tell he was trying, mm-hmm. and it made it seem a little bit like Jeff Daniels in Dumb and Dumber. Mm-hmm. And I kind of liked his dumb hats, and I kind of liked that Warren Beatty was able, like, wanted to put himself into that position. Mm-hmm. And I thought Dustin Hoffman was, like, giving. Like, he was really trying. And I think in a lot of ways, like, really working for me across the board. Corey, I agree with you. Like, the first bit of it, like, it's kind of like, I think that there's some real solid actual filmmaking in this movie, specifically for the first half. Like, I really agree, it gets so floppy and so lazy in the last half. But they're like, I swear to God, it happens where I'm like, I asked out loud, who are these guys? And it immediately goes to that, to how they met sort of flashback scene. Mm-hmm. Like, this movie is like there is like this structure and this competence of storytelling, at least within that first half, that I was like really impressed by. I also, so Elaine May, a reason I picked this, I kind of didn't go into it in my old spiel, is basically it goes back to Mikey and Nikki. I still think Mikey and Nikki is one of my like top 10, top 20 movies of all time, written and directed by, I'm not sure if she wrote it, but probably co-wrote it, Elaine May. And I'm just like fascinated by her both doing that movie as well as being like a standard of 50s, 60s, 70s like shticky comedy scene. And I felt like this movie had a lot of, let's say, old Woody Allen shtick. Like, this movie had a lot of like Steve Allen sort of like this like laughing sort of like hijinks that I feel like was even pretty rare for the 80s in terms of, maybe not so rare in the 80s, but definitely got more rare through the 90s. But like, man, I'm gonna tell you, let's talk about three fucking jokes. Let's talk about the fucking, like, they're being tailed by all of these people.
This was so good.
Stop laughing. And then when he stops and, like, the cars crash into
the
each other.
The cars crashing.
They're all
good.
Stopping. Yeah. That was, like, insanely funny. And then when they go through the market and the shootout happens and the one guy shoots the wrong guy and covers his mouth. like, could not stop laughing about that. Let's talk about the rug jokes where they go into the rug cellar. and they carry out the rugs and they say, all right, they're going to think you're in the rugs. Let's go up this way. Like, that's a solid fucking joke. And I'm so on board with Wizard about that blind camel. I thought that was hilarious to me. Like, what a mess that was.
Radar tracking of them, like, beeping around the desert in this stupid... Oh, my God. It's so stupid.
I mean, I was acknowledging that this was funny. I mean, I might have even been smiling, but yeah, none of this was making me laugh.
Sure. No, that's fine. And that's fine. Yeah. But so I do, it gets so floppy. Like, there's the MacGuffin, which doesn't even have anything. There's like the weird sort of, friend of Gaddafi.
The plot
I'm almost done. I'm almost done. Yeah. Like, there's this, like, you know, weird sort of Gaddafi friend who kind of, like, doesn't really have any characterization. Like, there's this, you don't get any texture of the world. It's not as problematic as I thought it would be, honestly. That auction scene is, like, pretty fucking terrible. But I still found it fascinating that at the end of the day, at the end of the movie, I find it fascinating and also kind of enjoyable that the ultimate conflict in this movie is, like, these two fucking assholes shooting against a CIA helicopter. Like, that's funny. Like, that's a pretty good situation and scenario. And that it's, you know, Charles Grodin or whatever trying to behind it. Like, there's something really dumb about that I kind of got some joy out of. So this is not a good movie, but definitely I enjoyed this way more than I thought it would be. And I'm not disagreeing with anybody else said. But yeah, those are my thoughts. Ishtar. That's my thought. Didn't mind it.
I feel like the plot was both convoluted and thin. At the same time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like when they were shooting at the CIA agents, I was like, how did we get to this? Why did they just stumble upon these guys just selling, I guess CIA guys selling weapons, which, you know, could be some part of commentary, but like also they didn't even bring a translator with them when they were one of the, it just doesn't make any sense. And so like, I wasn't brought along on the ride with it when like this stuff was happening.
The movie has no interest in doing that.
Oh, no, exactly. And the songwriter thing was dropped so hard.
So fast.
Like, so hard in a way where I think that's, like, just lazy, bad writing.
And it's almost like and whiplash when it comes back up at the end. Yeah.
And it's such a shame because, oh, yeah, fourth funny joke, the end of the movie, the CIA has to bankroll their album and promote it. I fucking died. But that's the strongest.
One of the worst things
the
CIA has ever done.
Oh my God. Well, that's the songwriting stuff is so strong. Like like I was reading about them, about Elaine May and the fellow that they brought in to like write the songs, and mm-hmm. the challenge of writing songs that are bad but not so bad. They're like mm-hmm. believably mm-hmm. bad. I guess Ernest is like kind of yeah. the tone you're going through. But that like Telling the Truth is a Dangerous Business song, that is a bop. That yep. is a bop. And the movie is definitely at its strongest when we're with these guys trying to be rock stars while also trying to be like a Simon and Garfunkel band. Like Dustin Hoffman's costumes in this movie, his variety of headbands. Too funny. Too funny.
I found that fucking annoying. Like, I found all of that. It was so contrived and not convincing. Like, I thought actually their performance was an affront to, like, to, you know, stupid people. Like, it's like, let's have these two incredibly, intelligent people, like, ridiculously intelligent people, pretend to be stupid. And I didn't even think they gave it the gravitas it needed to be funny, right? I don't know. I just, like, really just did not buy into any of it.
So it seems that Warren Beatty and Elaine May are, like, lifelong friends. So, like, that's how he got here. And then, I guess...
because she did according to Wikipedia, an uncredited rewrite of Reds. Yeah,
Or Tootsie. I saw
both, you said actually. Warren Beatty.
Oh, for
yeah.
Red. Okay.
Yeah, but you were talking about Warren Beatty.
Yeah, then she did an uncredited rewrite of Tootsie, which then Dustin Hoffman felt indebted to her for and stuff. And so I guess that's how she got these like stars to be in this.
That seems like a really thing. Bad reason to hire people. Well, like, I'm going to put these people in a movie because they owe me one.
I mean,
rather than I'm going to put
favors
people
like that all the time in my work. Like,
yeah, that's how you get boxed up a straw.
They're not funny, though.
Well, but I don't love the story around this movie. Like, to hear, like, Warren Beatty tell it, he's like, oh, I was doing her a favor because, like, she did a rewrite on Reds. And I was like, she's never really gotten a chance to do, like, the movie that she wants to make. So I kind of, like, went to bat for Elaine May. I don't like that story. Mm-hmm. And there may be truth to that. But, like, I don't like the idea that Warren Beatty is like, hey, man, I put my reputation on the line and she screwed me and things got out of hand and we didn't talk for 2 years after that. I don't like this story of this man being like, man, I gave her a shot and she blew it. Like, boo. I don't think that's the whole story.
Yeah, the more I read into it, the whole sort of feeding frenzy around the bad press it was getting felt like really yucky to me. And it was like, oh, this isn't that this movie was going to be so bad. It was just a feeding frenzy. That's what it seemed like. And I mean, all these were reported stuff, but like, you know, Roger Ebert's like beef with Warren Beatty about all this stuff. I don't know. That just seemed like, but also it seemed to be a pretty heavy dose of misogyny all kind of tinged throughout it with this problem with this like perfectionist woman director. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, movies bomb all the time. Like there seems like there's just a sort of a confluence of things that added to this like feeding frenzy here. I definitely don't think that it necessarily deserves all the hate that it gets, but
so let's talk about so we don't have to go through all sort of the plot, but I there's like there's something that I, because I do like the first half, I thought it went into, because again they are so old and it was so noticeable how old they are. And I did love the flashback. I did love the flashback of these old guys like finding bros among themselves. But it did, like, I think...
The scene of, like, Warren Beatty, like, waving his hand, like, because he wants to buy him a drink, and he's, like, over at the table, and he waves his... I thought that was cute. It's cute.
Carol Kane was my favorite thing of this movie, and she was in it entirely too short.
She tries to stick it out, you know?
But I did like that she did leave him when Warren Beatty was going to move in or something. I thought that was brilliant. I'm like, now that's the most realistic thing I've seen on this movie.
I think it, one big sin I think this movie commits in terms of Deus Ex Machina is that it doesn't make any sense why they get the Moroccan gig. And I was really excited at the end where it felt like he was another CIA agent who was just sending two doofuses over there. But I guess that turned out not to be the case. I don't know if anybody else had a different read of that. But like, I didn't know if that bothered anybody else or like the whole like, you gotta get them there. Mm-hmm. And I felt like they really whiffed on the get them there story.
It's strange because the initial offer is a shorter gig in Nicaragua, and they're like, and the agent is like, well, it'll be fine. It's just like, you know, there are death squads and stuff. And I'm like, okay, there's your premise. And then he's like, oh, I could get you in Morocco. Kind of the same thing, kind of the same issue. Maybe less death squads. Like, I'm like, why the Nicaragua thing? Like, other than that, the movie is kind of steeped in this like late 80s, like CIA mm-hmm. cloak and dagger stuff. But like, why Nicaragua at all? Why fake us out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he just, so, but there's, I guess that didn't bother me because I guess when you're breaking into act two, something has to propel you into that. Like if that was something that was like wrapped up at the end, I would feel like it would be more cheated out, but like, I don't know. It all just felt like just strange whiplash. Cause I was sort of enjoying the New York stuff as it was, but then he ends up in the airport and the woman wants his passport and his luggage. And he just, like, is he the reason why we have announcements in airports right now? That's like, you know, always keep your luggage attended. And like,
no, that's 9/11.
Oh, is that? No, really?
Yeah, no, you didn't have those messages. Didn't have those before?
Okay.
Oh, you could go into airports and hang out at the airport bar just for fun.
Yeah, that's true. So this is all just total coincidence, right?
Yeah.
That he just runs into her?
Yeah. He just runs into her. He looks like a complete and utter douchebag. So okay. She's probably like, I can get this guy. I can get this guy to give me his passport and his jacket and his suitcase.
But he does this whole spiel about like that he's not a homosexual and that you know, total respect. And then she shows him her boob.
Yeah,
and I'm just
everyone,
like,
yeah.
Really?
That
everyone
was weird.
Keeps, like,
that
misgendering
was weird
her for some reason. That's
so weird.
Why?
Clearly a woman.
Yeah. That's not.
Hey boy. It's like, that is a woman, guys. I don't know how to have you seen a boy or a woman?
Yeah. But I mean, this is where the true cracks of the movie start showing for me, because I'm like, why is he doing this? Is he just doing this because he is attracted to her and he liked her left boob? Like, and
it's
so the entire country civil war hinges upon this interaction here in this airport and like some MacGuffin map thing. Like, that's the, I don't know. It didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, oh, that's it.
Agree. Yeah.
It doesn't.
Very weak. Very thin. Fun fact. I'm pretty sure I've been to that airport.
Really?
Where is it? I think that's it's in Morocco. Okay.
Do you really think they filmed in the Moroccan airport?
Well, I mean, they shot it in Morocco.
Okay.
And that airport looked exactly like the one I had went to a couple years ago.
Right on.
Yeah. I mean, maybe. Who knows? But I, you know, but I was like, I'm pretty sure that I've been to that.
I will say too that like I liked that they gave them a win when they first did their first show
their
or whatever.
Nightclub routine.
Because like in a lot of movies, you could show them these guys being losers at the very bottom, and then they don't get a win till like the end or whatever. But like they killed it, and I actually like had a lot
they're
of fun
high.
Watching them like kill it with that little montage and stuff. I liked before when they're like, "Hey, what's your favorite like Simon and Garfunkel song?" And then everyone just keeps yelling out songs that are not Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah, that's amore. The woman keeps yelling out, "That's amore."
But I like that they got to show them having fun actually doing the music, because we've just been seeing them struggle the whole time. So
nice. I'll tell you that I agree with that throughout all of this movie. It kind of got me that they were bros. Like, mm-hmm. I kind of enjoyed their friendship, you know, and I think it could have been stronger, and I think it was a little weak, but, like, you know, there was too much in the desert, but there's, like, this one moment where the one's breaking down, and I was like, oh, they're bros. They're supporting each other.
Bros.
And I found that to be kind of nice in
a
way.
I will take that. That is a positive thing in this movie, even if I did not like who the bros were. But
solid
male
friendship.
Positive. Male positivity. Need to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, I did enjoy that. This movie was obviously written by a comedy writer. I wrote down multiple quotes that I can pepper in here. One of them, my life isn't that bad. I just have a lot of pain. Angela loves it. She's back on board.
I did like that part. I chortled. I chortled at that part. That was probably the only time I actually laughed in the whole thing.
I got this one. You've got the guts to say you'd rather have nothing than settle for less.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Yeah.
This like felt, I don't know if, has anyone else seen those like early 1960s Woody Allen movies?
Yes.
When it was like very Farsi and very, mm-hmm. yeah. I really felt like this had a lot of those like shticky elements in it.
Yeah.
It did, but there's something about it that it was missing that like, I just didn't viscerally get that feeling from this movie so that I would be in a headspace to be, to laugh. Like I love Bananas. Everything you ever
were afraid to ask.
I hesitate to admit that I love old Woody Allen movies. Mm-hmm. But I saw the similarity, but I was just like, you were trying to sell me something that I'm just not buying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really the plot. Sure. It's like the plot just doesn't work here.
And that's the problem, is that like them together is super fun, but there are parts of this movie where they're not together. Like Dustin Hoffman spends quite a bit of time with Charles Grodin, who we've mentioned in passing a little bit here. But when the Grodin shows up, I didn't mind. Yeah. You know,
but I just
when
I
the
just,
Grodin shows.
I have in my notes. They're just sitting here talking. Like
it is just talking. Yeah,
these scenes just like drag on, and like the there are funny things in it, but they're too far and few between.
And this is, I think, a problem that I have. I should get it diagnosed. But like, whenever Charles Grodin is saying something, I think it's fucking hilarious. Yep. And I'm like, yeah, I think we talked about it. What is that movie we watched?
I'm not
Real
infected
Life,
with that,
right? We watched Real Life. Listeners, go back to early Crit Club to watch Real Life. But like Charles Grodin's, like I think you said this when we watched that Wizard of his, just like burning hate that is just right under the surface. I find him so funny. And I agree, Corey, there weren't great lines, but something about the way Charles Grodin, it's like he's like Maya Rudolph to me. Like, it doesn't matter what's going on, I'm going to find it really, really funny.
Yeah. Yeah, he's just, I don't know. He doesn't have like a ton of funny lines. He's just doing like CIA guy, which is a role that you've seen other actors play in a million movies, where he's just kind of like jaded CIA guy. But there's just something about like his like demeanor, like his like physicality, or like lack of. He's like this like brick wall that you kind of have to act against. And then he does some small thing, whether it's intonation or like a raised eyebrow or something, that just like, he's so funny. Charles Grodin, always
agree.
Funny.
Agree.
Since we're talking jokes, can we call out Friends for stealing that that schmuck smuck joke?
Oh.
Yeah? No?
Oh, did they do that? I've never watched Friends. Anyway.
All right, so real quick, we have our Friends meme where Phoebe is trying to teach Joey French, and she walks him through a French sentence, and at the end she says, "All right, now say it all back to me." And he says a bunch of nonsense. "Ladies and gentlemen, what a smuck I was. Chuck Clark, schmuck. It's not smuck, schmuck." And then they go through the exact same beats. Say shh, say muck. Now run it together.
Huh.
Outrageous.
That does
is
feel
a
like
seed of comedy?
That does feel like a vaudevillian.
I know.
Patter. That feels like patter as old as the
classic
the hills.
Patter. It's classic patter, I suppose. And this is a classic patter film because we are trying to do like an on the road Bing Crosby and who's the other guy in those movies? Bob.
Oh
Hope.
Yeah, which I've never seen any of those. Yeah, I was looking either. Up that and seeing that this was kind of the inspiration, or that was kind of the inspiration for Elaine May wanting to make this movie.
What were?
Mm-hmm.
This series of road movies starring Bing Crosby and Bob Hope, where they just went to different, largely sort of Arabian, it seemed like, locations and, you know, fish out of water tales, probably. Like,
yeah, like goofy slapstick and all the kind of stuff that we're seeing here. You know, suave ladies man, and who is supposed to be Dustin Hoffman in Ishtar, if you're wondering who the suave ladies man in this duo is supposed to be. And then
the one who
Doofy
saw
Goofus.
Breast.
Yeah, the one who saw the breast. Although Warren Beatty's scene with Isabella Gianni is equally distressing and unfun. It's just this extended dry humping scene.
Oh my God.
Which made me, I was like, okay. Can we stop? Yeah. I know y'all are dating, but this is not good TV. This is not good filmmaking.
But seriously, do you all know of another movie that is as proto Dumb and Dumber as this one? Like,
no, it's
maybe that's another old as the hills sort of like trope, but like, boy, these like just two assholes like get involved with an international skirmish, like on a basically road trip, quote unquote. Like, I don't know. This just felt very much Dumb and Dumber.
Interesting. I love Dumb and Dumber, by the way. That is the top 20.
Yeah, I know you do.
Top 20 for me.
I know you do.
Warren Beatty's wardrobe throughout the film, especially his New York wardrobe,
yes,
definitely has that like Dumb and Dumber, like you look childish and stupid. No grown man dresses like this. What are you doing?
I think some of it too is like I didn't get a good enough feel of Dustin Hoffman's distinctive character. I feel like
he's Hawk. It's Warren a gang Beatty. Thing.
What? Yeah. But I don't know. I don't know how I could describe Dustin Hoffman's character in this. Really, like, I mean, he's sort of like, what is it, grandiose and delusions of grandeur and all that stuff. But, I mean, they sort of both have that. But, like, I don't know. He didn't seem very interesting. I thought Warren Beatty had the more interesting
I do
character.
Agree with you. Yeah, I completely agree with you. Like, where is the line for him, even? Like, the back and forth of CIA, like, I mean, it seemed like, I guess that's why I connected so much with, like, the bro-ness of it, is because that seemed to be the one defining trait of both of them, is that they wanted to be around each other and, you know, support each other where possible. You know, I don't know. But I agree with you. Like, thin character.
Those headbands did all of the acting, all of the character development for Dustin Hoffman. Let's nominate those headbands for an award of some sort.
I do think that Dustin Hoffman gave it his all, and it was more of the writing problem.
100%.
Yeah.
Frida was like, oh, Dustin is acting here.
Yes. Yeah. He's trying.
He's trying.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to go overly long into it, but for me, really, the movie did fall apart, finally. It really, that the tailing all of the tails shtick really kept me going for a very long time. And the camel just like, woof, I was on a solid simmer, baby. But when they go off into the desert, it really, like, I don't know what they're doing. And I don't know what they're trying to do. I don't know what, like, the script is trying to do. I don't know, like, what even the
like
people
losing all
sent
hope,
them into
I guess, but...
Yeah,
but it's like Grodin sends them there to die. Yeah. I don't know why the woman sent them there.
She also sends
like,
them
I
out
guess
there.
Also there to die.
Well, at one point she's, at one point she's talking to this unnamed like other dude in the resistance or whatever, who is like, he's like, send them out there to die. And I don't know, they have this conversation about, like, should we send men out there to, like, shoot them, or should we just send them out there to die? But, yeah, everyone, both the American government and this Ishtar, I don't know, communist, socialist, whatever group, they're all like, yeah, they're, like, leftist guerrillas or whatever. They're like, they'll go die in the desert. It'll be great. Although, again, because it's so flimsy, you're kind of like, well, why does it matter? Because they're supposed to be these two, like, prophesized, like, Muad'Dib types, according to this map that doesn't matter. The movie does nothing with the Messengers of God stuff.
Yeah, what's with the
The map is one of the worst MacGuffins in the history of film. It matters.
I agree with that.
Not at all. Which is so wild.
And yet, like, the entire revolution hinges upon it for some reason.
Yeah. For some reason.
But,
and I know that's what MacGuffins are, but, like, you know, even the briefcase in Pulp Fiction, like, serves purpose, right? Like, you get
it. The briefcase in Dumb and Dumber serves purpose.
The briefcase in Dumb and Dumber.
And that has a payoff. But I guess the important part is that they get that they're in the desert long enough to get dirty enough to get mistaken for brown people, because that's funny.
Oh, is that what happened?
Is that really what's happening?
I did not read that either. Oh, that's exactly what happened. That's why they think he can speak the language and all that.
I thought they were just expecting someone, and they're like, hey, you must be the guy. Because at first, they're like,
go
at first
rewatch
they see
it.
Him
he
from a distance.
Obviously,
like,
dirty from the desert.
So painful.
Yeah.
My
notes are why is this still a scene? This needs to stop. Please don't keep going with this.
I mean, I guess they got, I kept thinking, like, what is the actual purpose of this? And they got guns. They were able to fire back.
They got guns.
That's like, but they could have just, there are a thousand ways that could have gone.
They also got a great payoff, and this is maybe one of, other than the camel, maybe the most Dumb and Dumber joke in the entire movie, is the sight gag of Warren Beatty with blue dye all over his face. Like earlier, Dustin Hoffman is like, oh, don't wrap your face up, like the blue dye is going to leach onto your face. And then for the rest of the movie, for the rest of like their time in the desert, Warren Beatty has like blue stain everywhere except for where his eyes were exposed. And I just thought that was, again, like, despite this whole movie, despite myself, made me laugh so hard.
Hey, buddy, I'm with you. And like, I don't know the idea of Warren Beatty covered in blue on his face. I don't know. There's just something.
He blew himself before Tobias Funke.
Just like Truffaut or Godard's Pierrot Le Fou. My French heads will know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
It would be cool, like, to see. I wonder if anyone's ever done this, to re-edit Ishtar as if it was like an Arrested Development episode.
Oh, that'd be fun. Or like a serious political drama. Mm-hmm. That would be fun too.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's like, cause I don't know. Like, the desert just takes forever. I did kind of mildly find it funny when all of the birds. I don't know. There's something with the vultures. I don't know. But it just takes forever. But then again, I do find it ultimately interesting and entertaining that the main conflict, which wasn't well shot, which wasn't well scripted, is them shooting back, is like between the CIA and back. There's something, I don't know. And I don't want to give this movie too much credit to think that it was commenting. Well, it is. There's like commentary on CIA international influence and espionage, but.
Yeah, but it sort of just felt like it was a plot point they had to write towards, rather than like an actual outgrowth of the plot or the growth of the characters or anything like that. Like, it was just
they
end up getting to negotiate that the CIA publishes their album and promotes it worldwide, and I don't know. Oh, I did
applaud.
Like that there was a little like
applaud.
When they're applaud, the yelling applaud.
I like there's like the little bookend of them at the beginning of the movie looking at the wall of Simon and Garfunkel, and then they're looking at the wall of them, and then down on the lower right, it's like, you know, on sale, price is cheap or whatever. So it's like it's obviously not selling, and so they're trying
new
to get
low
rid
price.
Of inventory. I like that. It was cute.
I adored the scene where Isabella Gianni is in the audience and everyone is like, oh, what is this? And she is in tears and she's like, I think they're amazing. And she delivers the line so well, it's like so earnestly. I was like, that is so sweet. That is the sweetest thing.
She's in tears in every single scene that she's in. Like, she's
That is true.
Always crying. She's always like, she's always being misgendered. And then she's always like, using her sexuality to manipulate guys and stuff. Like, I don't know. It's a weird character.
It's kind of a thankless role.
Yeah. I also enjoyed that. I don't have a lot more to say about Ishtar.
Not really either.
I think this is a pretty comprehensive way of covering it.
Yeah.
Anyone else, Angela?
No. I can only say how much I dislike this movie so many times.
Great. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to goad you into more. I just want to make sure that you have the chance.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. To say
it
again if you'd like.
Don't have
me. No, that's fine. Well, let's roll. Here on Crit Club, we do things a little differently. Instead of more traditional rating systems, we go on a 1 to 20 scale in honor of the holy polydihedral, I always forget the word, the 20-sided dice. As all of us are big tabletop role-playing fans. So we rate things on a 1 to 20 scale. And let's just go in the order I went. Angela, how much of a 1 are you giving Elaine Mays and Ishtar?
I'm going to be generous because you guys clearly enjoyed it, and I am happy
well,
for
don't
you.
Well, don't do it
hey,
for
man.
Us.
Yeah,
no.
dude.
I don't need those pity rolls.
I want to give it a 1. A 1. I want to give it a 1 so badly.
Why not?
I'm going to. Let's do it. Critical fail. Hate this movie.
Ooh,
it's,
you
have I a feel,
1. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I just it feels like a movie made in a bubble that money could have done something far better for humanity. But I'm really glad that you guys got a good laugh out of it. I wish I could have laughed with you.
I got a bemused smile out of it. Those guys got laughs.
Yeah.
Listeners, also, you can follow along to our ratings in the handy spreadsheet of record, which is in your show notes, and see all of the ratings that we gave to all of the movies since. I mention it and now because, Angela, you have now given 5 movies of 1 rating, more than any of us.
Okay, so wait, what are the other films? Belladonna, Sadness.
Yes.
All About Love.
Did I give All About Love a 1?
Yeah. Police Story, yeah. Black Moon.
Yeah, okay.
Black Moon. There was something going on there, yeah.
Yeah, that, oh God, I did, really didn't like that movie. All right, I feel good about all those. Yeah, okay. Yeah, give Ishtar a 1.
Wizard, how are you feeling about Ishtar?
Oh, this is so hard. This is so hard. Because, like, you know, I'm experiencing like that weird, like, uptick in emotion that you experience when you, like, find something that was, like, you find, like, love for something that is generally considered terrible. And you want to boost that thing up and really, like, give it an extra helping of love and support. But I stand by, it is still just, it's just kind of like a middling, it's a mid-80s comedy with some very, like, funny bits and some deeply unfunny bits. Man, this is a hard one. I want to give it a 12. I'm going to give it a 12.
That because is the most... generous thing I've ever heard.
I don't think it is because at the end of the day, I think Dangerous Business is as good as Bridge Over Troubled Water, and that's where I'm at with Ishtar and Rogers and Clark and the whole damn movie.
Well, to remind you and our listeners, you have until the end of the episode to change your score if you wish. But for now, I've written down 12. Corey, how are you rolling on Ishtar?
So. It's better than A New Leaf, which I gave a 5. And the other movie that I thought about with this, the reason I knew your score on it, Angela, off the top of my head, because I was just looking at mine, was It's All About Love. It made me think of that. Where It's All About Love is also a really bad movie, but that one is starting to veer into it's so bad that it's good. It's All About Love, like I was watching it to see how bad it was going to go.
Yeah.
And so I think my feeling, and I gave that a 7. Which I was the highest of the bunch, giving it a 7. And so I think my feeling for this movie is like right in the middle of those two movies. So I'm going with a 6.
Ooh.
Yeah, I actually liked It's All About Love more than I liked this movie. More than Ishtar. Mm-hmm. Isn't that crazy?
Fascinating.
Yeah. For me, you know, I'm with you, Wizard, of like wanting to... Like that, like I'm trying to fight back that urge and trying to be more.
I feel protective, you know, but I shouldn't.
Yeah, because fuck me, man, I laughed. Like, it's not an exaggeration that this, like, among the 70 some movies, I think I laughed at this movie maybe more than any of them. Maybe is that true? That's probably not true, but fuck me, this movie tickled me sometimes.
Sometimes.
I'm not gonna say it's a good movie, but I still feel strongly about an 11. I think that's where I'm gonna sit right now. I would watch this movie again easily. Like this movie, like I want to see some of those shticks again, and I think it's like just kind of interesting in its time and place, even without the story around it. So I think 11 is kind of where I'm sitting with that, and I'm like really delighted that we got to watch Ishtar and have this conversation about it. So thank you all for that. And if you want to tell us what you would rate Ishtar or what you think of this movie we watched or any other ones before that, you can reach out to us at email at critclubpodcast@gmail.com or find us on socials at critclubpodcast. Let us know how we're doing, what you're thinking. Let us know movies that you wish we would talk about. Let us know the movies that you enjoyed us talking about. We would love to hear from you.
I just created our Blue Sky account. There's nothing up there yet, but
oh, great.
We'll be on Blue Sky now.
Find us there. But that's going to do it for me and my pick this week. And next week we will have a completely new pick, and it's a wizard pick. Wizard, what are we watching next week?
Oh my goodness. So this week was very challenging. There are a lot of things I want to watch, and I was really interested in exploring some other much maligned bad movies. And so I was on the fence about taking us through a little adventure through a well-known flop known as Heaven's Gate, released in 1980. However, It's a long, long movie, and
I'm okay with that. Like,
I understand. I understand, but I also just, I don't think that even, like, as an experiment, I have fuel in the tank for this thing, because I maybe it's great, maybe it's not, but it's like a long Western about stuff. I don't think I got the spoons for it. Maybe we'll come back to it, maybe not. But I decided that we would do a little trip back onto the silver screen way back. We are going to be watching Things to Come, directed by William Cameron Menzies. This is a science fiction film from 1936, starring Raymond Massey, Ralph Richardson, and Cedric Hardwick. It is a landmark collaboration between writer H.G. Wells, who was still alive at the time. He would die a decade later. Producer Alexander Korda, who we know from the incredible spectacle of Thief of Baghdad, and designer and director William Cameron Menzies. This is a science fiction film, a prescient political work, a predictor of a century of turmoil and human progress. It is an early, very serious science fiction film. It's supposed to have a lot of visual spectacle and a lot of exciting things for us to enjoy, and I think it'll be really fun. It'll be fun to keep kind of like poking around these sort of like these big pictures of like early film, these like big high concept things. And so I'm very much looking forward to us watching Things to Come.
Yeah, that's gonna be awesome. Thank you, Wizard. Really look forward to that. All right, that's going to do it for the main portion of our show. But as always, we love asking each other the question of, hey, what else are you watching? I'm going to go in reverse order here. Corey, what else are you watching?
All right, so the Razzies. We can get into it. We don't have to get into it. But yeah, so right now they have the Criterion Channel has the Razzie sort of collection where they're just like putting up bad movies, I guess, to hopefully get some people on their streaming service. And... right after watching Ishtar, I was like, Peter's always talking about, what is it, Mikey and Nikki. Yeah, Mikey and Nikki. And I'm like, okay, I'm gonna watch that to compare for this. But then I saw Freddy Got Fingered sitting there, and I sat and watched Freddy Got Fingered, and it's way better than Ishtar. Like, way better than Ishtar. Okay. I haven't seen it since it was, I saw it in the theaters in 2001. And I remember like being kind of like, what was that? But it's so interesting to see how now, like nearly a half century later, how much comedy has moved toward Freddy Got Fingered. Like that style of comedy is what comedy in like a lot of circles is now. And so definitely thoroughly enjoyed Freddy Got Fingered.
What is Tom Green did an uncredited rewrite of American Beauty for Sam Mendes, and that's how he got cast as Freddy Got Fingered.
Like, it got me thinking of, like, I don't know what Tom Green is doing these days. I mean, he was definitely a part of my teenage years very much growing up and stuff. I don't think he's written or directed. I mean, I think he's probably acted in some stuff, but I don't think he's written and directed anything. And I just thought about, like, what would it look like if he kept getting work and he was able to sort of evolve his, like, and get better at, like, his style and all that stuff. And it was just like, what a sad timeline we live in where Tom Green doesn't get anything greenlit, but like M. Night Shyamalan just keeps getting like checks written out to him. Like it's sad.
We are very different people. Let's be much old.
And I guess just the other thing is I'm rewatching Game of Thrones. I might have mentioned that before. I'm rewatching it with Noah, who has never seen it, and it is a lot of fun rewatching that show when you know what's going to happen and the person you're watching it like doesn't know what's going to happen. And Noah loves trying what's going to happen in movies and trying to guess what's going to happen in TV shows. They're always like saying, oh, that's going to happen, that's going to happen. And you just can't do that with Game of Thrones. It just doesn't work. It's a lot of fun. That's about it for
me. Great. Awesome. Who was next? I think it was Wizard, if we're going backwards. What else have you been watching?
You know, I've been kind of out of being able to watch stuff for a little bit. I've been super busy. I was enjoying some time watching the Cosmos and catching that sweet eclipse, and so I was unable to watch a ton of TV. I will say that I'm still enjoying King of the Hill, and I really hope that a bunch of people have been inspired to start watching King of the Hill. I am on season 5, episode 4, Spin the Choice. It's their Thanksgiving Day episode. Super funny. Also loving Shogun, which continues to be the ultimate dad tale of how the very first weeaboo conquered Japan with just a plucky sense of entitlement. I shouldn't actually say that. Like, they do a great job. Shogun does a really great job of, like, telling Japanese stories featuring Japanese people, in addition to telling the story of this white dude who shows up in Japan in the 1600s and is like, what's going on here? Like, it's a really interesting story that I really recommend. It's super violent. It constantly has these, like, sudden, like, super graphic scenes of violence. Like, a few episodes ago, like, I saw a bunch of men and horses get blown up by cannon fire. I was like, wow, where did that come from? Still, it's a fun time. I am also still playing Helldivers, and I'm having fun with that. We just recently pushed the automatons out of Super Earth space, but they've come back.
Oh, no.
With a vengeance. And we're still waiting for that third or fourth faction to drop. I know there are more enemies out there, and I cannot wait to spread democracy to new and vibrant places. So that's what I'm up to.
Angela, what else have you been watching?
Oh, I jumped on the Shogun train last week and got myself almost completely caught up. I haven't watched last night's episode yet. Totally agree with Wizard. It's a banger. Highly, highly recommend this show. It's one of the best paced shows I've seen in a long time. I don't mind the violence. I mean, if you like Game of Thrones, this is a fantastic show. I'm kind of sad because this is just one book, and I'm really hoping that the production team behind the show, because I mean, it's quality. I can't say one bad thing about Shogun, so I hope that this production team makes other stuff. I'm eager to find out what those things might be. It's just thoroughly satisfying. I'm also watching on YouTube Dungeon Soup, which my friend Andy has recommended. It's like, what if Adventure Time was all about the Dungeons and Dragons stuff? And there was a big fighter that looks kind of like an overgrown Beavis. It's kind of fun and silly, and there's only a few episodes. Look it up, Dungeon Soup on YouTube. And then, am I watching anything else? No, that's it. I'm busy studying to become a realtor, everybody. So I have my nose in a book and not on the screen.
Good luck.
So grateful that we're not watching a 4-hour movie. Thank you. And that's what I'm watching. What are you watching, cool. Peter?
It wasn't intentional, but I did sneak myself away on Monday to finally see the Dunening, part Tunening. So I did
that's
see
a good one.
Dune.
I haven't heard that one yet.
That's a movie. I don't know. do people like that movie? Has everyone here seen that?
Oh, yeah. The second Dune? Yeah, I've seen it. I liked the first one better. It was way more vibey. I get it. I've read both of those books. I know what's going to happen.
Well, this is still the first book.
I know, but it you know, inches towards
it's a big book.
The second one.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was there for it. I'll watch whatever else Mr. Villeneuve puts on the screen.
I'll maybe watch it when it comes on streaming or something. Not a diehard fan of it.
So I agree with Angela. Like, I think I liked the first part of Dune, like the first part, like the House Atreides stuff, the attack on the Atreides compound and all that stuff. That is like meaty drama, and like I think those are the parts of the book that people like really remember when they think of Dune, other than like the sandworm riding and stuff like that. I think I think my main issue with the second part of Dune is that it is way more vibes based than the first one. Like, I think the visuals of the movie do like way more lifting of the storytelling than in the first movie. We're dealing with fewer characters and you know, we know that Paul's goal is to like reclaim his birthright and revenge on the Harkonnens and all that stuff. But like the movie, just like the second one in particular, spends way more time on like epic shots of Paul looking brooding and conflict. It like kind of manufactures some conflict between Paul and Chani that doesn't really exist in the books. And it cuts out some stuff that I would have liked to have seen. I'm always a big fan of Paul's sister Alia, who gets excised from the movie. at least like as an adult or as a child with an adult's brain, like we don't really get mm-hmm. any time with her. But it's cool. It's cool. I guess like I would have liked to have seen more like psychedelic weirdness from the second Dune movie, because there is a lot of psychedelic weirdness in the book that doesn't really get explored. Like more exploring the Paul's prescience would have been interesting.
Yeah, this movie, I still don't know how I felt about it. So thank you all for talking. Like I've been wanting to hear what other people's thoughts are, because I think I agree that it's vibes based, but I did not connect with those vibes. Mm-hmm. Like it felt like it's weird because it felt like this should be, it felt like the vibes were too broad, like going after too broad of an audience, but also like whenever things did happen, it often felt like in a rush and that they weren't fully explained mm-hmm. in a way that I'm like, should this have been another two movies? But that's, you know, should this have been like three movies of this one book? But then also, I don't know, but also like it's still like knowing what comes, like knowing what that second book is like. I didn't love how much it was like set up, you know, these underdogs, and like Paul's this underdog who's going to take back this thing. It's just like this weird sort of like disconnect with what will happen with the jihad and the billions that he will kill, you know, moving forward. It's just like I don't know, that there didn't seem to be any of that sort of emotional contextualness or like texture, I guess is what I'm looking for. It kind of all seemed a little bit boiled, like too condensed into like, you know, just kind of like big movie platitudes. At the same time, it's fucking gorgeous. At the same time,
super pretty,
stunning, like absolutely stunning to look at. Like no regret seeing it, because I just really loved watching and being amazed at how they brought so much of that stuff to life.
I do have a question. I do want to ask a question, Peter, since we're talking about this now, and I don't know when I'll see you again.
Sure.
Friend of the pod, Christopher Walken as the Emperor of Mankind.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought it up.
Woeful miscast, or?
I like twice laughed out loud in the theater, like in like shouldn't have, like couldn't stop myself, because it was so bad to me. I felt it was like crazily out of place. What are you like? It was just so fucking stupid to me. Personally, is what I felt, and
it's very
like, guffawed accidentally.
Who would have been a better choice? I'm just curious.
I don't know. Like somebody that's not so obviously Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
Like it's just like painting a character on this target. Like you just can't. Like basically, Christopher Walken has to be Christopher Walken now. You know, in any movies, like he just has to be himself. And I don't think like I don't see within him like, I don't know, gravitas or like. But also, he had no part really. Like he said all of like five or six words, and he was just kind of like a stand-in for, I guess, what that represented. And I don't think he carried that with that gravitas. I don't know. Whatever.
Like I guess like if the point is to make the Emperor look old and beaten.
Sure.
Christopher Walken is a good choice. Like late period Walken is a good choice for that. But I don't know. Yeah, like there's very little, and I guess you know there's the, you know, he's not supposed to exude menace. He's not even really that interesting a character in the first Dune book, right? But like,
yeah,
it's just strange. Anyways,
I don't know. It was one of those movies where I felt like I liked it more and I liked it less for having read the books a couple times, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like I was able to take away sort of I was able to, like, I knew more of what it was saying with Bene Gesserit sort of strategizing more than I think maybe more other audiences might, because I don't think they did a great job of sort of laying all that out. But at the same time, knowing what's coming, I didn't love how it handled a lot of the, like, you know, heroes rising up sort of stuff. But that's, you know, a few other things, a few horror movies, but I don't know if anything exactly worth mentioning at this point in time. So I think that's a good time as I need to call it. Unless...
Well, I had one more thing I forgot to mention.
Yeah, please. No,
and
no,
I can't not mention it, because it was one of the best things I did last weekend, was I saw the movie of Ryuichi Sakamoto's Opus, which is, he was the musician behind all the music in Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. And other
Commandant.
Major films. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. He was also the Commandant.
Commandant
and...
eyeliner.
Right. It was gorgeous. It was a sweet movie. I don't know that it's necessarily like you have to run to the theater, because it would have been way nicer to just hear it in surround sound in my house or something in the dark. And it's very repetitive. But I had a good time watching it. It was very relaxing. If you need something to just like help you meditate or fall asleep or relax, this is, you know, that movie Opus. I think it's going to be shown a little bit more throughout this month. Ryuichi is no longer with us. He died last year. So this is your chance to say goodbye.
Thanks for mentioning that. Yeah, that's going to do it for Crit Club for this week. Thank you for watching Ishtar with us, everybody. And we are excited to watch along with you What Wizard next week.
Oh, we'll be watching Things to Come from 1936.
Another thing to come is our podcast on that movie. So thank you, Crit Club, for tuning in and watching the notorious bomb Ishtar with me. Thank you, Corey. Thank you, Angela. Thank you, Wizard. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.